The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Dr. Doug Groteis, he is the professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary, and he is a frequent guest on the program. We're going to be talking a little bit about Christianity and economics, but the American Worldview Inventory in 2021 noted that there's a seismic generational shift in worldview. The headline was, Millennials Seek a Nation Without God, Without the Bible, Without Churches. But if you abandon God, Bible, and churches, that doesn't mean that you don't believe in anything. For people who substitute a belief in God, they create their own God and they look for a way to solve problems. Recently, Doug, you gave a lecture on Christianity and economics. And the subject was, in fact, this growing infatuation with socialism. Why did you think that this was significant enough that you're thinking, I need to talk publicly about this?
Right. Well, I was asked by a church, the Well Church in Boulder, to give a talk on this. And I said, sure. And then my wife, Kathleen, said, Doug, do you know anything about economics? And I said, well, I've read a lot about it over the years. I've never given a one-off lecture on it. But then I realized that a lot of people, younger people, I'm 64, we're about the same age, didn't live through the Cold War and don't know what Marxism, communism was about, don't know how socialism takes away liberty and really enslaves people. And there are a lot of people today, not to stereotype, but a lot of millennials led by people like AOC, the Democratic congressman from New York, who have a very rosy, idealistic, optimistic view of socialism. They have enemies, bad guys, the capitalists, the big corporations, the wealthy people. And if we could simply spread the wealth around a little more fairly, we'd have a more equitable society. And people who have not looked at history and really haven't considered some basic facts of economics find that to be extremely attractive, along with, we were talking about the idea of getting smaller houses, smaller cars. Maybe the very idea of private property is not a good idea.
Yeah, in this American Research Center, the American Worldview Inventory, they said several interesting things. Younger Americans significantly more likely than previous generations embrace horoscope, karma. What's interesting is they talked about owning property as fostering economic injustice. It was a sort of a concession where if you ask and answer the question, how would you feel about abandoning the idea of private ownership? More and more millennials are open to the idea.
Right, until somebody wants to take their iPhone. So it sounds very good in the abstract, but private property is actually assumed as a good thing in the Bible because the commandment not to steal presupposes private property. Now, we're told that God is the owner of all things and we are stewards. But if you don't own property or if you don't aspire to own property, then guess who gets to own it? The state. And it becomes a matter of governmental authority what is done with property. So really, private property is a hedge against the total control of the state, because if I own something and I have jurisdiction over it, then I have certain rights and opportunities and privileges and responsibility for my property, whatever it is, a car, a home, whatever it is. So I don't think people are thinking very clearly about this when they think that private property is somehow the engine of greed. That comes out of Karl Marx. That comes out of Marx and Engels' work in 1848, the Communist Manifesto. It's not anything you'll find in scripture, and actually it doesn't make a lot of sense.
You know, one of the things that you, when you gave the lecture, you're talking about the premise, the basic premise of economic injustice or social injustice, that millennials are looking around and they're saying, hey, I perceive that there are real racial disparities. There are real economic disparities. So they're looking for a solution to the problem, and they're looking at socialism as the solution to the problem. And you argue that it's okay to think about injustice. It's okay to think about what's gone wrong in the world, but how do we begin to just even think about how to define the problem and how to fix the problem?
Right. Well, it's a very big issue. But first of all, disparities do not in and of themselves mean injustice.
Mm-hmm.
There can be disparities in income and educational achievement for a number of reasons. Personal values, one's aptitude. Some people select out of certain professions. For example, most nursing is staffed by women because mm-hmm. women tend to gravitate towards the more nurturing professions. Overall, in general, that's just the way it is. So if you say, well, something's radically wrong because there are more women in nursing than men, there must be some strange injustice going on. Probably not. And in terms of economic achievement, yes, there are great disparities of income. But then you have to ask, why is that? And one of the key features of socialism is the idea that wealth is a zero-sum game, they call it. Think of a pie. So if I eat 80% of the pie and you only get 20, I'm greedy. But free markets, the free enterprise system, is not like a pie. You can create wealth by making new products like computers and cars, and you end up hiring new people for your factory, and people purchase these products because they desire them, they benefit from them. So if I have a certain amount of wealth and someone else doesn't, it's not the case that I have stolen that wealth from them, or I have set up a system that disadvantages people. Maybe, I mean, there may be elements of that. There certainly were elements of that in the United States previously, especially before the Civil Rights era. A lot of African Americans didn't have the kind of economic opportunities and opportunities to live where they wanted that whites had. But most of those kind of structural problems have been addressed legally and culturally. So the first premise of socialism that really gets it going is false, and that is my wealth is necessarily someone else's poverty.
And when we to use that illustration of the pie, and because you're a philosopher, you would automatically seem to gravitate to the question, who made the pie? Does the person who actually generated the pie have some say in the pie? You know, does a Steve Jobs who creates Apple, or a Bill Gates who creates Microsoft, or of Henry Ford, who creates a car and then builds the car and then presents it for consumption, do they have a say in how we get to go forward?
Well, someone's got to create the wealth. And that's one of the key problems with socialism. It talks about redistributing wealth and wealth inequities.
But not wealth generation.
Not the generation and creation of wealth through a free enterprise system and private property. I think it was Margaret Thatcher said the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money.
Doug, you recently gave a lecture on this subject, and you opened with a reference to Nomad Land. I was unfamiliar with this film. Tell me a little bit about the film, the premise of the film, and why you thought that this was an appropriate way to begin a conversation about socialism and economics.
The film is based on a book by a journalist named Jessica Bruder, who wrote a book called Nomad Land, I think about 2 years ago. The film won an Academy Award for Best Film. My wife and I, Kathleen, saw it. It's well done. Mm-hmm. And it's about a new class of people who are sometimes called nomads. They have other names for themselves. They don't have homes, but they have They have homes in their cars.
Like vehicles or RVs type
they
thing?
They live in their cars. They transform their cars, their vans, whatever, into homes. And they don't have a permanent residence. So they're seasonal workers. And the film traces people that perhaps lost their jobs in the financial downturn of 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. or have not been able to manage retirement in a home. So they're considered houseless, but not homeless. Their home is their car. And I watched an interview with Jessica Bruder about the film, and she said, well, this shows the problems with capitalism because mm-hmm. it generates a system where people can't retire comfortably, can't get decent work. Some of these people work very, very long hours in seasonal work, or they work in an Amazon plant, and they end up hurting themselves because of the repetitive nature of the work or all the walking. And she recommended something which is called a living wage. So if you don't get the wage that you need to sustain life, the wage should be set by the state so people get enough to live on. Now, how could you be against a living wage? Well, I'm for a starvation wage, you know. But living wage is basically a minimum wage law. Mm-hmm. And the idea is people should be given enough money to live on. Sounds good. But what happens is when you create a minimum wage, especially a higher minimum wage, mm-hmm. as Biden wants, employment goes down because employers can't pay everybody $15 an hour, so they don't hire anybody. And a lot of people think that if someone is getting a minimum wage, they will stay in that minimum wage for their whole lives. And typically people cycle in and out of low-paying jobs. A lot of lower-paying jobs are taken by young people. I mean, when I was in my 20s, I raised support for a ministry, mm-hmm. and I made very, very little. I probably could have qualified for food stamps. Mm-hmm. I never even thought of it because I was fine. But I was only in that wage bracket for a few years. Mm-hmm. So something like a living wage just sounds so wonderful. Let's just spread the wealth around, and these people deserve more money. But there are some hard facts of economics. There are constraints and incentives, as Thomas Sowell so often says. And if you have to hire somebody for $15 an hour, you have to hire one person for $15 an hour and not two people for $8.50, that's going to constrain what you can do. Maybe you'll say, hang it, I won't hire anybody. Mm-hmm. So there are what are called unintended consequences to state actions with respect to the economy. A lot of people never see that. They are so idealistic. Mm-hmm. They think you've got these greedy corporations exploiting the workers, so let's intervene and make a minimum wage so that everything is more fair. Well, in an ideal world, that's fine, but people seek their self-interest and their economic incentives and constraints that have a role to play. But this film really tugs on your heartstrings because there are people who are struggling, living mm-hmm. in campers, living in cars. Some of them love it. They choose to do it. Other people are doing it because of economic
necessity.
And so you think, well, look at these people. They should have a home. And can't we just somehow provide for everyone and not have Jeff Bezos make $1 trillion a second and these people are barely surviving in their RV working in his warehouse?
So we're back to the pie illustration. Jeff Bezos makes the pie.
Right.
He bakes the pie. He creates the pie. Mm-hmm. And then people partake of the pie. And so people rarely think about how many people that Jeff Bezos employs, but he's generating wealth. Right. So if we ask and we answer the question, how much wealth does the government generate?
It takes taxes. The civil government extracts.
So it doesn't generate any wealth. It takes other people's wealth from you and me.
Right. That's the way civil government works. And that's the great thing about free enterprise is that people are allowed the possibilities of creating new products, distributing those products. And you have to meet some kind of a felt need to create a product and have it be successful. And also, I want to talk a bit about the profit motive. Mm-hmm. I was driving a few weeks ago and I saw a sign that said people, not profits. Mm-hmm. I thought, wait a minute, this is a false dichotomy. Wanting to make a profit is legitimate, mm-hmm. and profits are necessary to develop businesses. You have to sell something for more than what you make it. And if you develop a profit, then you can reinvest that profit, hire more people, create more goods, provide more services. And yes, you might be a greedy capitalist. You think of that iconic film, Wall Street, where the character Gordon Gekko, you know, the reptile name, Gordon Gekko says greed is good. But that's a personal problem. That's a vice. There's nothing about capitalism or the free market system as a whole that encourages greed. It allows for greed. But if I can read this quote from Adam Smith,
sure.
Even when people are greedy, it's not necessarily bad for the economy. I do want to make a distinction between greed and self-interest, but let me read this classic quote from a book called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages. He's talking about how a market system works. Now, people may exercise charity. That's up to them. And we should, as Christians, be extremely generous and liberal in our giving. But a market system works on the basis of self-interest. I develop a product. I want people to buy it. They buy it. They benefit from it. And it's legitimate self-interest. But let's say someone has nothing but a greedy concern. They're still capitalists, so that means they need to make a profit. And if they want to continue to develop their business, they need to reinvest their profits, which generates more goods, more services, more people employed. So the genius of a free market system is that while it allows for greed, it certainly doesn't necessitate it. But even if someone is greedy, if they want to continue to make money, and they do so within the constraints of a law, you need to have a civil government in place to enforce contracts and so on, protect private property. Even if they have nothing but bad motives, they still have to make products people want. They still have to hire people who need work. And they still have to provide general goods for the whole society.
So let's talk a little bit about the contrast between the vice of greed, but the virtue of work. In other words, if we ask and we answer the question, is work, according to the Bible, a virtuous activity? And should work be determined by A, the government, B, the culture, or some C, the individual? Who are the players as we ask and we answer the question of who's responsible for work?
Yeah, basically, you go back to Genesis. God created male and female in his own image and then said,
get
to work.
In the garden and said, work.
Get to work, develop the creation, have dominion over it. And work precedes the fall. A lot of people think that work is a result of the fall, of being alienated from God. No, it's harder. It's more difficult because the ground is cursed. But God is a worker. God created the world, said all things are good. And then he gave us the opportunity to work for him and to love our neighbor and develop the creation into cultures.
The world is making the case that socialism is wonderful. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the failed examples in Venezuela. In other words, everywhere that socialism has been practiced, it has fundamentally failed. But people might say, well, wait a minute, China isn't trillions of dollars in debt, but they are. Venezuela, they're not in debt. But they are. Is it possible, Doug, to understand socialism without understanding economics? How wealth is created, how it's generated, how it's distributed, or how it's misused or abused?
Well, not really. I think the call or the allure of socialism is idealism. And this very simplistic idea of a zero-sum game and a false view of what disparities mean. And somehow if we just had the agency of the state to confiscate and redistribute, we could solve these kinds of economic problems. So go back to the 1960s in the United States. You see the germ of this with John F. Kennedy, and it came to fruition really with Lyndon Baines Johnson. It was called the Great Society. or the war on poverty. Sure. And it was further propagated, interestingly, by someone more conservative, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And the idea
was,
on
the heels of Lyndon Baines Johnson, right. and which is a different great society, but again, a redistribution of wealth.
Well, that was the idea. The idea was America is a great country. We led the war effort. We defeated the Axis powers. We can get rid of poverty. So you declare war on poverty. We're going to alleviate it. And social scientists like Charles Murray and Thomas Sowell and others and Walter Williams have looked at the data. And in fact, the war on poverty didn't help the poor very much because it created incentives not to work. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, even incentives for single women to have more children out of wedlock because they could get more money the more children they had out of wedlock.
Yeah, the basis of that was called aid to families with dependent children.
Exactly.
You got more money if you had right. more. So the way that you generate the wealth is by having a child, which ups the amount of money that the government gives.
Right. It's fostering dependency, and it's also encouraging immorality. Now, nobody who set this up had that in mind.
Right.
They had this zero-sum, top-down approach to poverty. They didn't really understand the cultural and existential reasons for poverty, which are essentially existential. Do you have a long-term approach to life? Are you willing to delay gratification? Do you have a family concern? Are you willing to save? I think it's Star Parker, who was a welfare mother herself for years, said, the way not to be poor is to graduate from high school, don't have children out of wedlock, take the first job you can get, and don't commit crimes.
Hmm.
She's an African-American woman. Now, obviously, racism plays a role in this. I wouldn't deny that for a minute. But essentially, there are activities and attitudes that people can engage in that are far more productive than any state program that's going to try to redistribute wealth, create new programs, gigantic bureaucracies, and then you have these unintended effects like you see with the so-called Great Society. And many minority communities suffered under what was called the War on Poverty or the Great Society. You look at their statistics for things like employment and family structure and education, they actually got worse with the Great Society program. So you had all the advantages of the civil rights movement, Brown versus Board of Education and so on. But then when the state tried to be kind of the messiah for solving poverty through this gigantic mechanism, a lot of it backfired. And that's what's called the law of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So when you think about economics and social policy, you have to try to consider human motivation and also the limits of what the state can do. The state has tremendous power to extract funds, to dole out money, to arrest you, to conscript you, but it's not always the best means by which to help a particular problem. But people have that assumption. It's called statism.
Mm-hmm.
Statism. Mark Levin often talks about that, the dangers of statism. The state is what unifies us. The state is what can save us. The state is where we go when we have a problem. And that doesn't encourage self-government, personal responsibility, and so on.
So back in the day when Karl Marx first thought about, he's in the Industrial Revolution, he points to inequities in jobs and he basically argues that that people are forced into factories and that they're forced into this oppressive situation. Fast forward to just even about 10 years ago, there's a growing sense that the problem isn't so much an industrial revolution, but some other kind of revolution of oppression, that America is a fundamentally flawed state, that it is even, in fact, a wicked state and an oppressor state, and so that we have to change this oppressor state in order to get rid of the problems.
Well, then we're getting into what's called critical theory or critical mm-hmm. race theory, which is a neo-Marxism or cultural Marxism The categories of concern are not so much economic as they are racial and
social and
sexual.
Cultural and sexual.
Right. So people are divided into the oppressors and the oppressed, and what makes you an oppressor or an oppressed is your pigmentation mm-hmm. or your gender orientation. It's a very simplistic, reductionistic account of things. For example, think of the suffering of a lot of lower-income people in Appalachia,
mm-hmm.
hillbilly elegy.
I didn't get to see that, but I hear it's a pretty compelling story.
Yeah, I've seen part of the film. I haven't read the book yet. I have it. But this is an intergenerational problem of poor white folks in Appalachia with drug problems, employment problems, health problems. And I think we need to look at the people who are disadvantaged economically and say, well, what could help them recover? What would be a way to help whoever is economically disadvantaged? Red, yellow, black, white, gray, green, whatever it is. What could help them? And I think it's rather silly to say that someone who has been out of work for 2 years, who's hooked on prescription drugs in Appalachia, who's a 25-year-old man, has white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
No, he's suffering from poverty.
And when you ask and you answer that question, and you say, well, here's option number one, confiscate money from the rich and give it to the poor. You know, it sounds cliche to say, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach him to fish, he eats for a lifetime. But even in that cliche, there's an underlying principle that seems to make way better sense.
Well, it does make more sense because wealth transfer does not generate the kind of character needed to be successful in life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not against what you could call
hand
safety
up,
nets.
Hand out, yeah.
Yeah. I think there needs to be safety nets for people that are mentally ill or people that have no recourse whatsoever and they need some kind of shelter or temporary subsidy or something like that.
Right.
Free market people are not against those kind of things. What we're against is a socialist system that ends up regulating and controlling property and takes away freedom and opportunity from people. I've been really motivated recently to defend free enterprise and the free market in light of the resurgence of socialism, and the whole woke culture or the social justice movement is very socialistic. Whoa. And I'm realizing that a lot of younger people just don't know the history of Marxism. They don't know that Marxist socialism was responsible for 100 million deaths in the 20th century. And they think somehow, well, that's a long time ago, and that was just a failed project. We can do it over again. Mm-hmm. We can have some kind of democratic socialism.
Well, do you get a little bit concerned? Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're an academician, and you're in that public academy mm-hmm. called education. Do you get a little bit disturbed, not when our liberal friends lean left, but when the body of Christ, Christian institutions, embrace critical race theory and intersectionality and what people are talking about, that the woke virtue signaling, where Christian are saying we need to have a director of sensitivity for racial injustice.
Well, it's such a can of worms, isn't it? Because human beings are unfair and unjust to each other, and racism is a real aspect of being a sinner.
Right.
But the issue is, how does it affect society as a whole? What are the causes of disparities? Is it always racism? Is it usually racism? Very significant question. You've got to consider economics, personal worldview, mm-hmm. history, all these things. But I have been conservative politically for a very long time through my research.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young man, when I was in my 20s, early 20s.
You wouldn't really characterize yourself that way,
not,
probably.
Not early on. No, right. In fact, when I was, before I was a Christian, I was kind of a hippie or a neo-hippie. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was assumed you held to some kind of socialism. I remember seeing Arlo Guthrie give a performance in Greeley, Colorado in 1975 or 76, and he was singing, "This Land Is Your Land, This Land mm-hmm. Is My Land."
His dad's song.
And I turned to my friend and I said, "Socialism, this is great." So after I became a Christian, I actually gravitated towards the more leftward-leaning people like Ron Sider and Jim Wallis, Sojourners Community.
Yeah, who had written prolifically on this subject.
And they're still out there. Although Ron Sider has gotten a little bit more conservative over the years. I don't think he would call himself a socialist. But as I began to think about it and read people like William F. Buckley and R.J. Rushdoony and a variety of other thinkers, and to consider the hard facts of economics and the failure, the utter failure of socialism, which is always a form of statism, which I take to be a kind of idolatry, and Francis Schaeffer very much influenced me on this too, I changed my mind. And before I gave this lecture last week, I went in my office to see just how many books on economics I had and had read. And I had many, many books that I read mostly in the 80s from people like Ronald Nash and David Chilton. And, of course, I've been reading Thomas Sowell steadily for 40 years. He's a great defender of the free market and an African-American man. So I'm concerned. I think that Christians are very motivated to work for what's good for the poor and the oppressed and minorities. And we should be, because Jesus said, as you've treated the least of these, my brethren, so you have treated me. There's so much in Scripture about caring for those that don't have a voice, that don't have food, that don't have clothing. You can't get away from that.
Do you think part of the problem is the church, not throwing the church under the bus, but by saying for the church who says, well, you know what, let them go on welfare, let the state provide. In other words, where the church says they sort of become complicit in an ideology that says the state, it's the state's duty to provide for the citizen.
I think some people think that way. We shouldn't, because the state cannot provide the spiritual nourishment that people need. For example, my church years ago had a family stay in the church. They were homeless, so they said, you can stay in the church. And, of course, people were ministering to them, praying for them, sharing the gospel with them. But they put a limit on it. They said, you have to look for work.
So you had to come up with a plan for self-sufficiency.
Exactly. It's not you can just keep continuing to get a benefit from the state. We're going to help you. It's going to be holistic. We're going to help you with food, with where you live, with counsel, with biblical values. But if you stop looking for work, you have to leave. And sadly, they stopped looking for work. So the church said, we're sorry, but you know what Paul said,
if you don't work, you don't eat.
You don't work, you don't eat, or you don't look for work.
Right.
You know, we have to draw some lines here. So in that case, a church very proactively reaches out to help a homeless family, but they have an investment and they have a gospel perspective to bring to bear, whereas the state can do some good, it can provide a safety net and so on, but because it is the secular state, it can't preach the gospel, it can't call people to repentance. That's a violation of church and state, and I think it is, really. It's limited. Whereas private individuals, churches, philanthropic organizations, whatever they may be, the Rotary Club, the YMCA, they're all these independent organizations. Who was it? Edmund Burke called them little platoons, I think, that are not state-sanctioned or state-sponsored, but they have a lot of entrepreneurial concern for the lost. So they can use their ingenuity, they can use their money, they can use their spiritual values to bring to bear and do a lot more work than what the state itself can do.
My guest is Dr. Doug Grotius. And Doug, in the very few minutes that we have left, what are some key concepts about resisting socialism? Here people are listening. Clearly, you've been concerned about this. As regular mom and dad, citizens of the United States of America, who actually like a constitution and the first, the second, the third, even the fourth and the fifth amendment, and they go, you know what, I'm not really ready to abandon a constitutional republic. I want to resist socialism. What would you say to them?
I think you need to study. There's an excellent book. It just came out, 2 years ago in a 10th anniversary edition by J. Wesley Richards called Money, Greed, and God, The Christian Case for Free Enterprise. I just read the second edition a couple weeks ago. Richards, Money, Greed, and God. That's a good source. There are good sources like the Hoover Institution. There's an essay online called Democratic Capitalism Exceeds Socialism and Economic Efficiency as Well as Morality.
Mm-hmm.
Just study, know the history, and realize that socialism gives you a bevy of false promises. It gives you a very good feeling that you can be part of a wonderful solution to help the poor. You have the victims, you have the victimizers, the rich are the bad people. And somehow if we just spread this around through the state, we can alleviate the problems. And it's been tried. It doesn't work. It takes away individual liberty. It tends to sap private charity and the kind of organizations that really can help the best. As I mentioned, the little platoons mm-hmm. of society. And it essentially makes the state into a false god. So I think that book by Richards is very good. J. Wesley Richards, Money, Greed, and God.
Wow.
Good place to start.
Thanks so much for being my guest.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.